Good morning. I actually haven't had the opportunity to introduce myself. My name is Dr. Elliot Malamud, and I'm the co-founder of Torah in Motion along with Rabbi Kelman. And it's my pleasure actually to reintroduce Rabbi Broyd, who I have had many discussions with at conferences over the years, as he will tell you. So my questions this morning were not out of the blue. We've tussled many times before with great pleasure. The reason that we've switched Rabbi Broyd to this slot is very simple. He arrived here at 6 o'clock this morning after an all-night journey from Atlanta. So as you can, we won't get into the details of how that worked, but as you can imagine, he is somewhat fatigued. And Rabbi Dr. Steinberg has very graciously agreed to flip his session with Rabbi Broyd. So at the slot where Rabbi Broyd was originally scheduled to speak will be Rabbi Steinberg's session on stem cell research. But for the moment, Rabbi Broyd is now going to speak on perspectives on cloning. Won't you please re-welcome Rabbi Dr. Michael Broyd.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Feinberg. Thank you so much for switching with me. I have a long night to travel, and I got here at 6 in the morning, and obviously I need to rest a little bit before Shabbos goes on, so I asked to switch so I can catch a little bit of time to catch up. The topic of voting is not at all a lot of the so no matter what I conclude at the end of this event, you can't go out and clone yourself, even if it's Mutter. So we'll be a little bit more theoretical and abstract than we were before. But you have to put cloning in an intellectual context of the halakhic tradition of assisted reproduction. I'm not going to talk about the interrelationship of stem cell research and non-reproductive cloning, because I see many other people are going to touch on that topic or even address that topic frontally. I'm going to talk about reproductive cloning, a technology that doesn't yet exist for human beings. There's no intuitive reason why it shouldn't or can't exist for human beings. We've cloned any number of mammals. It doesn't exist for people because the government has restricted in various forms reproductive cloning, and so it doesn't exist. But talking about reproductive cloning helps raise a set of analytic issues about how halakha views assisted reproduction. And I guess we start with the story, and it's important to trace where it goes. After World War II, there was a very intense set of conversations about artificial insemination with the donor's sperm. Many men came out of the Holocaust infertile. They got married. They wished to have children anyway. They could not have children, so they wished their wives to be artificially inseminated with donor's sperm so they could appear to have children, they could raise children as if they were their own. And there was a very intense halakhic controversy about whether artificial insemination with donor sperm was halakhically proper. The Tzitz Eliezer and the Sofer Rebbe both took the view that this conduct was not proper. The Sofer Rebbe took a very firm stand against it, labeling it in certain contexts, even Manzeris. Rav Moshe Feinstein took what I think has become the predominant intellectual view. Rav Moshe says as follows, that artificial insemination with the donor's sperm is not a sin, because the sins associated with carrying a child other than from your husband relate to sex and not to procreation, and that when a woman is married to man A and is artificially inseminated with the sperm from man B, that's not adultery at all. That child is not illegitimate in any way, shape, or form, because the sin of adultery involves sexuality, not reproduction. And indeed, although we don't have an enormous amount of assisted reproduction with donor sperm, we maintain a halakhah l'maaseh that in appropriate circumstances, artificial insemination with donor sperm is mutter. The preference of Rav Moshe Feinstein writes is that the sperm should be from a Gentile and not from a Jew, so as to eliminate even the vague possibility of Manzeris. But even if the sperm is from a Jew, Rav Moshe maintains that the child is legitimate through and through because mother is the birth mother. And other folks can maintain that the mother is the egg donor, is the genetic mother, the egg donor. This controversy remains an open controversy as a matter of halakha. My own personal view, for what it's worth, is that the birth mother is the mother according to Jewish law, but I would candidly acknowledge to you there's an open controversy as a matter of halakha, and you have to be strict for both views. Cloning, in the reproductive sense, is simply the next step in this conversation of treatments for infertility. There are, on occasion, situations where men suffer accidents so severe that they have no sperm at all. Typically, they have no testicles. Sometimes this is from military activity. Sometimes this is from industrial accidents. Whatever exactly it's from, it's from. Reproductive cloning holds out the possibility in these situations of allowing these men to reproduce. How will this work in theory? We already know how it will work in theory. We'll take the genetic material from a man, from his cheek. We will take an egg from his wife. We will destroy the DNA in the egg. We will put the DNA from the man into this woman's egg. We will then implant the DNA, the egg, in the mother. She will carry the child to term, and she will give birth to this child. This child will be, in all but its mitochondrial DNA, identical to its father. It'll be born by its birth mother, who will have no direct genetic relationship with other than mitochondrial DNA. And everything will, so to speak, look normal. Meaning, when you see a pregnant woman and her husband walking around, you don't go to them and say, "How did that get in there?" Those are not the kind of questions we ask. And when a child is born that looks a lot like its father, you know what people won't say? People don't say, "My gosh, that's amazing. Your child looks just like you." And so it's contrary. It's amazing, so to speak, when a child looks completely not like its mother or father. And the question is, how would halakha view this kind of activity? Again, we don't do this now, although it's unclear exactly why. But I can tell you why, and I can voice a lot of opposition to it. Socially, when you think about cloning, people all of a sudden start to flip at it. And by the way, the same thing occurred when artificial insemination and surrogate motherhood first started. When artificial insemination first got started, the literature said as follows: we should prohibit this activity. You know why? Women will turn to their husbands and say, "You're a nice guy, a good husband, but frankly, I'd rather have the father of our children be Albert Einstein or Michael Jordan. Pick your hero." When surrogate motherhood came about, people said, "Oh, this is a terrible thing. If we allow surrogate motherhood to occur, men will turn to their wives and say, 'You're a wonderful wife, but I don't really want you to be the mother of our children. Genetically, I'd like to have either Madonna or Madame Curie,' again, picking your own hero, one way or another." It turns out, though, that both of these fears are not correct. It turns out not to be true. Artificial insemination is never used by happily married fertile couples because the wife likes the husband but just doesn't want him to be the father of the child. The old-fashioned way to have children is so cheap and so efficient that's what people do. The only time people go for artificial insemination is when the natural way doesn't work. And the same thing is true with surrogate motherhood. People aren't in happily content for a marriage, but look piercingly into their wife's eyes and say, "As a wife, you're wonderful, but I don't want you as the genetic mother of my child." That produces divorce. Surrogate motherhood is used only in situations in which there's a fertility problem. So this same conversation is starting with cloning. People, when they first hear of cloning, you know what they think of? In my generation, they think of the boys from Brazil. And in my son's generation, they think of Star Wars. But in fact, it's going to turn out over time that really what reproductive cloning is another form of assisted reproduction for dealing with hard cases of infertility. hard cases of infertility will be dealt with through cloning in the way I described. A man with no testicles will be able to produce a child with his wife that's genetically just like him, comes from her, she'll be, so to speak, like the surrogate mother, and they'll have a child or even many children this way. So while Rebecca looks at these technologies and says, well, these are not ideal ways to reproduce, because Rebecca has a bias in favor of the old-fashioned natural way to reproduce, in all of these situations, Rebecca is result-oriented. What do I mean by that? Rebecca looks at Jewish children who are born, you know what it says? That's good. Having more Jewish children is good. The best way to have more Jewish children is the old-fashioned natural way. But if you can't have children the old-fashioned natural way, Rebecca says, you know how you should have children?
Anyway, you can.
And certainly artificial insemination of the husband's sperm, which is unnatural, is a fine, good thing when necessary. In vitro fertilization is a fine, good thing when it's necessary. And I suspect that the same result will ultimately be reached in cloning as well. People will ultimately come to view cloning from a halakhic perspective as another form of assisted reproduction. In those situations in which a man can't produce sperm, cloning represents a viable way to allow a husband and a wife who are happily married to produce a child. Now, there'll be all sorts of questions about this child. What will be the questions? Who's really the child's father? Who's really, to some extent, the child's mother? After all, you could say as follows. I could give you two different thought processes for thinking about fatherhood. I could say that the father of the child is the donor of the DNA when the donor of the DNA is man. Because, look, if the producer of semen is labeled the father, and he just produces half the DNA, so when a man gives over all of the DNA, you know what he definitely is? The father as well. I could have that rationale as a reasonable explanation of fatherhood. This man is married to this woman, and he produced all of his genetic material necessary to make his child, so he could call him the father. The mother, I think, is, in my view, at least the birth mother. And even those post him who think that the mother of the child in normal cases of surrogacy is the genetic mother, the egg donor, might not take that view here, because there is no genetic mother from a biological perspective, because all of the genetic material functionally comes from the father. And in the case of where there are two competing mothers, you might have a preference for the genetic mother over the birth mother, but in a situation where there's no birth mother, where there's no genetic mother, you certainly, I think, as a matter of logic, would be inclined to say that the birth mother is the mother as a matter of halakha. If this analysis is right, then reproductive cloning produces what looks like a fairly natural family. A man and a woman are married. They have a child. The mother of the child is the woman who waddles into the hospital, goes into labor, and gives birth. That sounds pretty normal. And the father of the child is the man who goes with her, who's made a genetic contribution to the child. Now, you can play this out a little bit more abstractly and bizarrely. You could point to all sorts of halakhic peculiarities. You could argue that it's not this man's father, it's not the genetic donor who's the father. You could argue, as you'll see, some folks can talk about, maybe this man's, the genetic donor's father is the father, and that this child should be treated as the twin, because this child is really his genetic identical twin. I don't find that argument particularly persuasive as a matter of halakha, because I think on these kinds of areas, halakha is very naturalistic. This man's wife went into the hospital, went into labor, and gave birth. She is the mother. The father of the child is thus the genetic contributor in these kinds of situations. So I think cloning fits into a paradigm different than is generally portrayed in the press. If you read the popular press, you're very much inclined to think about cloning as sort of this wild, ethically uncertain activity. We're going to make people to be organoids. We're going to make people
problems by creating clones who are just kind of half people, but not real contributors to society. Or we're going to worry about people cloning Hitler. Or maybe, you know, a better version of that is people cloning great basketball players. I think that from a halakhic perspective, all of those things would be very problematic. And of course, we would need governmental regulations to prevent abuses of cloning by which people are cloned to be body parts, or by which people are cloned because we want to clone dozens of basketball players to make sure we win the gold medal in the Olympics year in and year out. But I think that when you step back and you look at the history within the United States of where these technologies really go, you see that within human beings, where these technologies really go are they go to assist the people who are desperately in need. Halakha recognizes that people have a real need to have a child. And some people have a real need to have any number of children. And I think Halakha recognizes that that need is real, and it pushes poskim farther out. Meaning, a woman has the right to say, I want to have a child who will take care of me in my old age. Tomorrow tells us that that's a sufficiently strong right. You know what she can do? She can even use it to divorce her husband in certain circumstances. If he's had children from a first wife and he's no longer having children with her, he's already fulfilled his obligation of her removed. She has not had any children. She can say to him, I wish to get divorced. Being a pusher of the other, she can say, I want to get divorced so that I can have children so will take care of me in my old age, even though she has no halakhic obligation to have children, because I'll recognize the normal, natural right of people to want to have children, partially to take care of them in their old age, partially because children are an intrinsic good thing. Whether in most circumstances a mitzvah in a summer of Purim or Rav, and in other circumstances a mitzvah in a Rabbanan. But Halakha recognizes that when a couple is married, having children is a normal, natural, good thing. And I think that while we look at cloning and we say, gosh, this technology can easily be abused, we could have said the same thing about assisted reproduction, and we could have said the same thing about surrogate mothering. The truth is that cloning will be brought into our society not to make great football players or to solve organ donor shortages, but as a form of dealing with very severe cases of infertility. And in such a situation, Halakha looks up and says, oh, this is a very positive use of this technology. It's a technology that increases the number of Jewish children born in the world, and in such a circumstance, it's a good thing. It gives rise to technical questions. And technical questions are technical questions. They need technical answers. I think Alpidin, the birth mother, is the mother. I think Alpidin, the genetic donor, is the father, but I'm not 100% sure. I think Alpidin, the siblings of this child, would be other children produced by this man, either naturally or through cloning. I'm not sure how we would handle Kalisa. It might well be that we would say in a situation in which this man predeceases this woman and had no children naturally, that she needs Kalisa Misafin. When a man dies without any children and he has a brother, his wife needs Kalisa before she can remarry. It might well be that children born through cloning, even though they're product of natural birth, don't fulfill the Torah obligation of brewer, but when a woman needs chalitza in that situation, that might well be the case. But it seems to me that when we look at cloning through the eyes of reproduction, you see that the notion that cloning could be a useful tool in a dealing with cases of infertility certainly is a halakhically proper approach to thinking about how we deal with matters of cloning. And this steps back and perhaps presents us in a more general view of both Jewish law and where we stand in contrast to other traditions. The Catholic tradition looks up and says, my gosh, assisted reproduction is wrong. God created a way to create children in the Derech HaTeva, the natural way. And you're under no obligation to ever step out of the natural way, and in many situations, the Catholics say, all tinkering with nature is wrong. If you're infertile, suck it up. That's the way God created it. That's the way God created you, live with it. That's not the Jewish view of technology generally. And that's certainly not the Jewish view of assisted reproduction. We think that God created a world with problems. Sometimes I have problems, sometimes you have problems, sometimes there are just problems out there. Our mission is to fix these problems. Fixing these problems frequently requires tinkering with nature. And we don't view tinkering with nature to be at all a bad or a problematic thing. Tinkering with the reproductive process to allow people who are infertile to no longer be infertile through artificial insemination, through in vitro fertilization, maybe even through cloning, would not, in the halakhic tradition, represent a deep and direct violation at all. Would it be better than the natural way? Of course not. But it's a perfectly fine, proper, and appropriate way for people to reproduce in those situations where this is the only available way. So I think that it's important to say this over and over again for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's this assertion out there in the name of the Judeo-Christian tradition, whatever exactly that means, that we are opposed to cloning. We're opposed at least to reproductive cloning. I don't think that that's true. I don't think the Judeo part of the Judeo-Christian tradition is opposed to reproduction. I'm not sure there is a Judeo-Christian tradition. But to the extent that there is a Judeo-Christian tradition, the Judeo part of the Judeo-Christian tradition is not opposed to reproductive cloning, subject to reasonable regulations to prevent it from being abused. Second of all, it recognizes that the having of children is a very good thing. However exactly a couple goes about having children is a good thing in and of itself. Meaning, you could imagine methods that aren't so good, but at the end of the day, when a happily married couple comes to you and says they're having reproductive difficulties, they need assisted reproduction, in general, the Jewish tradition says, yes, that's a good thing. Assisted reproduction is a positive, proper activity for people to engage in. And I think cloning is one such example. So I don't want to scratch my head in befuddlement at the federal ban on reproductive cloning. There is a federal ban on reproductive cloning in the United States. I assume that there's such a ban in Canada as well. You are not allowed to do reproductive cloning. And I find myself somewhat befuddled by it. It's a wholesale adoption by our government of a policy that's uniquely and narrowly limited to the Catholic tradition that represents a view that's very foreign to us. Of course, as you get into more exotic or weird things, so we step back and we say that's not a good situation at all. Let me give you an example. Sometimes, I've encountered it now twice in my philosophy of intervention, you have what they call human-human chimerisms. Human-human chimerisms are very scary to me. Maybe not. Human-human chimerisms, I first encountered it, is a way that lesbian couples reproduce. There's an adoption problem in the United States. It goes as follows. If two lesbians are living together, we just have to have an adult conversation here, and they want to have a child, they have a legal problem. What's their legal problem? They both want to invest in the child, but only one of them has rights, and only one of them can be the mother. So what will they do? I'll tell you what they do. They will take an egg from each of them, inseminate it with the sperm from the same man, and then you know what they will do? They won't complain to both, that each of them will be a mother of one child. They will combine them together to make a single egg that's a human-human chimerism with genetic material from both women in a single egg. Now you would say, gosh, can they do that? And the answer is, yes, they can. They certainly can. Now, the United States government has said many times, don't do human-human chimerisms. But you should know that there are assisted reproduction facilities that do the human-human chimerisms as a service to the gay and lesbian community. I think a model would use something like that, which is a subtle form of cloning at a certain level, with a great deal of disquiet and unhappiness. And it would shouldn't be done merely as social convenience for people who are in a peculiar circumstance. Never mind the more bizarre cases of human-animal chimerism, which is definitely weak. About 10 years ago, a lab at Stanford did a human-mouse chimerism. They let the fetus from human-mouse chimerism, and they took a mouse egg that had been fertilized, and they mixed it with a human egg that had been fertilized, and they merged the two into one egg, and they let it grow through 11 days of pregnancy. And the FDA stepped in and said, stop. You must stop. We are freaking out. We are at the limit of our ability to be comfortable because you're doing a scientific experiment and we're thinking about spiders or mouse men or some other exotic activity. You must stop, and they stop. And as far as we know, there's been no human-animal chimerism in the United States since then that's been spoken about. These kinds of reproductive activities, I think we're very scared of. They strike us as both unnatural, somewhat dangerous, and at the end of the day, serving no reasonable purpose for reproduction. But a married couple that's having reproductive difficulties, and they seek to have reproductive cloning, his genetic material, her egg, implanted in her uterus, she goes to the hospital, has a baby, and he calls the father or the abba or the dad, or the top of the head, she's called the Ema or the mother, or whatever else you want to call her. I think a lot of the stuff with that, you know what he says? Mazel tov. The mazel tov. Another human baby born, that's a perfectly fine and proper good thing. You go into weirder, more complex cases of human chimerism, or human and animal chimerism, I think a lot of the stuff that says, oh, in those types of situations, you'd really have to show us an enormous need. So before you engage in that type of activity, perhaps a medical need, perhaps some other profound need before we would allow the mixing of human and animal DNA, or even human-human DNA. Although if you were to show me a real medical need to do this, like a couple both of whom were take-back carriers who could address the fact that their child might have take-back by a chimerism from a human that didn't have take-back, maybe that would be a lot more acceptable to be a fulfillment of a mitzvah or a kosher or a pet. I'm hard-pressed to imagine what mouse genes would do, but maybe you can imagine a situation where the introduction of a single mouse cell into an egg would be a good thing as well, although it makes me somewhat queasy. So let's summarize, and then we'll take some questions. I think reproductive cloning, like all forms of assisted reproduction, when done to make more Jewish children between a man and woman who are happily married to each other, is a good thing. And we would favor that use of reproductive cloning to address cases of severe infertility. The farther away we go from that paradigm, the less comfortable halacha becomes with it, precisely because it recognizes that as a matter of Jewish law, when a married couple wants to have a child, that's viewed as a good thing, and the further you deviate from that, the less good that is. Thank you very much. I'm glad to take a round of applause.
I'm sorry, I'm going to take the prerogative, and maybe we'll do questions later on, like in the evening or after lunch, just because we're a little behind schedule, and Rabbi Breuer is extremely tired, so I'll step in and let him take a break. We do have the entire weekend, so we will give an opportunity. There is a panel tomorrow just for general questions, so that we can't get to it. Just want to keep more on schedule.
And once again, I wanted to thank Rabbi Sondra for graciously letting me take the class. I apologize for leaving.